Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com. Welcome, Jim. Today, what we'd like to talk about is some of the things that have been going on worldwide with the nuclear things popping up in Iran and Korea, and there's been more news about Iran that they're really close to having enough uranium for a bomb, and they've also done some missile testing recently. It's a concern at the UN. It popped up there, and so it seems like a really hot topic right now, a topic of concern for everybody. But I know a couple of times we've talked here about Iran, about that even if they do have a bomb, that they're probably not going to be able to deliver it with a missile for several years, because the hard part is mating that nuclear weapon to the missile in order to launch it.
Yeah, the most curious thing about what I call the third generation of nuclear powers, the first generation was the United States, quickly followed by Russia using our technology, which we later found out. The second generation was China and most of the several European countries like France and Britain. And then the third generation, which actually initially arrived in the 70s when Israel and India, in South Africa, well, a little later, achieved nuclear weapons status. The Indians did it and then backed off, said, "Oh no, we were just, you know, testing the water. Nothing here to see, folks. Move on." The Israelis never admitted it, and the South Africans got rid of it. Then, of course, we have in 98, the Indians and the Pakistanis, well, the Pakistanis basically got it. They set off bombs which apparently mostly didn't work. They fizzled, which we've covered fizzle. Search fizzle, that strategy page, and you'll find out all about bombs that don't go boom like they're supposed to. And the Indians then did a lot of tests, so there was this sort of orgy of nuclear weapons testing. It's since come out that some Indian people who were involved in the test said that not all the Indian tests worked out as they were supposed to. The Indians and the Pakistani leadership have since denounced this talk of their bombs fizzling. But then we have the North Korean test, at least the first one, apparently being a fizzle. And the jury's still out on the second one, which might have just been a bigger fizzle. A fizzle is basically a nuclear explosion that is very, very low grade. It's not a big bang. In other words, it's much significantly smaller than the Hiroshima bomb. It can still do a lot of damage, but it's really not ready for prime time. That brings us to the question of, okay, if you have a bomb, what are you going to do with it? Israel has apparently put several dozen of its nuclear weapons on missiles, but apparently their primary delivery mechanism is still, you know, F-16 or F-15 fighter bomber. The Pakistanis and Indians have bombs that can be delivered by aircraft, and it's uncertain exactly where they are, as you pointed out, in engineering a warhead. As I've mentioned in an earlier podcast, I actually have some personal experience with nuclear warheads. When I was in the Army years ago, I was involved in maintaining, the American version of Scud, which was a solid fuel, you know, missile called Sergeant, with a nuclear warhead. And we talk shop, and the nuclear warhead guys would tell us their problems, and I'd tell them my problems, and we'd figure out ways to jury-rig the weapon to do what it's not supposed to do. But anyway, the thing I came away with was, this was a very complex piece of work, and what people have told me since then, through several generations of nuclear warheads, that it is not a trivial exercise for a ballistic missile warhead to deliver anything, because the damn thing is coming down, returning to Earth. It's going through a lot of gyrations. It's pulling a lot of heavy G's, which puts stress on, you know, any sort of mechanism that is inside of the warhead. There is heat to worry about. In other words, it's a hostile environment. And in developing these warheads, the United States and apparently Russia, from what came out after the Cold War ended, there was a lot of trial and error, and there were periods during the Cold War, it has since come out, where whole classes of warheads or missiles carrying particular types of warheads were ineffective because there was an error made in, you know, changing or upgrading the warhead, rendering it ineffective. This happens to the U.S. Navy. It happened to the Russians with several models of missile. So the bottom line is it's going to take years for any of these people to get a workable ballistic missile warhead. In the meantime, you still have to worry about them flying it in on an aircraft or a UAV. Or, of course, there's the submarine option. We pointed out that it's very worrisome that a country like Iran has obtained cruise missiles for their Kilo-class submarines, their Russian submarines. This is a missile somewhat smaller than some of their ballistic missiles in terms of warhead size that could carry a much less sophisticated warhead because a cruise missile obviously does not go through anything near the gyrations that a ballistic missile warhead has to endure. And if they're going to have a warhead, a nuclear warhead, that would be the way to go. But the problem is they haven't even got a nuclear weapon. If they do, and then they follow the path, as it were, the well-worn path of the other third-generation nuclear powers, they're not going to have a workable weapon on the first try. And so you said a couple of years, well, quoting me, a couple of years to get a warhead on a missile, but I'm thinking 5 or 10 years to have anything, you know, usable. And then, of course, the next question is, who are they going to use it on and how are they going to use it?
Right, and Iran's pretty much telegraphed who they're going to make their attack on. It would probably be Israel.
And, of course, as we pointed out that today in strategy page, Israel not only has a anti-missile system, which is capable of dealing with what few missiles the Iranians now have to throw at them, but they have far more ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads, as well as aircraft that could easily penetrate, whatever air defenses the Iranians have now. In other words, the Israelis could not only parry whatever nuclear attack the Iranians could make today and in the next up to 5 years or more, but they can retaliate with nukes. Now, that brings up another question, and this is one that, you know, this is the elephant in the room nobody wants to talk about. What would people really need to allow them as a nation to retaliate with nukes? I mean, nukes are the big no-no. I mean, nukes are an odd weapon. They've only been used twice. They've been largely responsible for the longest period of peace between the major powers in modern history. Although there are thousands of them, well, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 available, it's uncertain if anybody would have the wherewithal to actually use one. I mean, among the major players, we know there are terrorists and perhaps even Iran who says they would, but Iran, based upon their track record, Ahmadinejad, you know, talks an interesting game, but he's the exception by Iranian historical standards, even by current standards, because he has been basically shut down by people who outrank him. He's the president of Iran, but he doesn't run Iran, who have said that, no, Mr. Ahmadinejad is, in effect, the court jester, and we have adults around who make the real decisions. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to in Iran. Right. He has certain things he's in charge of, but he is not in charge of the nukes. And especially not in charge of making the decision whether or not to use a nuke. The way Iran has operated for the last 4,000 years, and the past is prologue to the future in a case like this, their nuke would be used as a threat, not as a weapon. Which brings us back to the question, who would use a nuke? They're much more effective as a threat than as a weapon. Because once you start slinging those things around, I mean, you're into Dr. Strangelove territory. There are no winners.
Right. Well, and especially for Iran, if they actually launched one, the retaliation would probably be more than they would be willing to accept, I would imagine.
It's probably true, given, again, Israel has a history, as a short one as a country, a much longer one as a distinct, you know, ethnic group. They say, they don't say we're going to kill Iran, but they do say never again. And from all the Israelis I've met of all ranks, they are deadly serious. You try and do another, you know, Shoah on us, baby, and we're right back at you. So if there is to be, I think the next nuclear exchange could definitely be somebody trying to nuke Israel and getting nuked in return. But Pakistan and India, people, at least the, you know, the responsible adults who are allegedly running the two countries and the chattering classes in both countries have said, no, the nukes are, they're just there as a defensive measure. You know, nobody has any intention. Because apparently the word got around real quick in both countries, who, but India especially had been anti-nuke for a long time. So you had several generations of people growing up on, you know, anti-nuke propaganda, for want of a better term. The Pakistanis to a lesser extent, but they're all in general agreement. We don't want to use nukes. Most other countries are really the same way in their own way. I mean, every country is a little different. China, for example, still has a relatively recent memory of getting trashed by Japan. So they love an excuse to lay a nuke on Japan. Indeed, one reason why the Japanese don't make a nuke, which they could do very quickly, is because they are, and they don't like to say this too loudly, it would give the Chinese an excuse to nuke us.
Right.
The bad feelings are fairly intense between China and Japan. But the Russians want nothing to do with another big war, because again, they still have a long memory. They lost about a third of the population in the 20th century between various wars and internal, you know, democides. So they have no interest in using nukes. And of course, America, you know, there are some Americans who would say, you know, nuke them into the Stone Age and what have you. But at the highest levels, as far as I can tell, once you get up, the closer you get to the football, that little gadget that controls the actual, you know, use of nukes, the less enthusiastic you tend to be about actually unleashing your nukes. So we have everybody trying to get a hold of these weapons, but not as a weapon.
More as a threat.
Exactly. I mean,
right.
Nuclear weapons are unique. They are in their own category. There's never been a weapon like this. And as General LeMay, the guy who basically was in charge of dropping the only two that have ever been dropped, his attitude was, hey, it's just another big bomb.
Right.
And for all practical purposes, since the radiation was little understood at the time, that's all it really was. And that has changed over the years. It's no longer just a big bomb. It's the end of the world. It's, you know, whatever. Although military, you know, the military historians will tell you, well, yeah, it's basically just a big bomb, but if you throw enough of them around, you can cause, you know, far more damage than just a bunch of, you know, a couple of hundred, a couple thousand big bombs. It's not going to be the end of the world, but it's certainly going to be the end of, you know, a comfortable middle-class lifestyle for, you know, hundreds of millions of people. In other words, it's a scary weapon on a scale that no other weapon has ever, you know, practiced. It has basically scared people into not making war. And this apparently is what most countries, all countries as far as I can tell, that are trying to get a hold of nuclear weapons, this is what they're looking for. They're looking for scary, not, you know, mass murder. They want something that will protect them. Now, in North Korea's case, it's basically a bunch of, you know, tyrants who want to protect their police state from, you know, they want to protect their little things.
Right.
And that's all they want it for. They want a regime insurance. Because I don't know why the international, you know, courts have not, you know, brought down, you know, crimes against humanity charges against Korea. Maybe it's because they think they're going to have nukes. But they have certainly done it. I mean, they have killed millions of people in the last decade, you know, mainly through starvation, and of course then they have their prison camps. So it's a means of protection for either a country or, in the case of North Korea, for a few thousand, you know, people with a lot of blood on their hands.
Right.
But it's no longer a weapon. And indeed, those fizzles, as embarrassing as they might have appeared, didn't interfere with that to a great deal. Something went boom in a much bigger way than just a large, you know, pile of TNT, and therefore I'm a nuclear power. And you keep testing it just to remind people, yeah, we got nukes. Whether we can deliver them, you know, in a workable fashion is another matter, but that's besides the point. If you believe we have nukes, then we can threaten you. Of course, where this becomes a problem is that it encourages neighboring countries to get nukes. South Koreans are talking about it. Japan is talking about it despite the threat from China. They say, hey, we can always suck up to China, but those North Koreans are really nuts. By the way, there's much more bad feelings between Korea and Japan than there is between Korea and China, because the Japanese occupied Korea for over 40 years and they were not gentle. I was over there for a year when I was in the army and I got it firsthand from a lot of Koreans. You know, you talk about the Japanese and they get a little red in the face and it goes downhill from there.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that could lead to the use of nuclear weapons. So we have an American diplomats have been aware of this for decades, and this is why we try and, you know, stop proliferation, because in the hands of people who have deep and long-lasting animosity for one another, this is where things could fly out of control and the nukes could start flying. But despite that, so far, it's basically an insurance policy.
Right. Now, one of the things that is altering the ballistic missile threat is Standard Missile 3 for the United States,
that has been spectacularly successful, but it's as successful as it has been, it's not the, you know, the magic wand that is going to invalidate, you know, all nuclear weapons. The problem with anti-missile systems, and we have several successful ones right now. We have Patriot 3, which is good for anything, for shorter-range ballistic missiles landing within 20 kilometers of a battery, you know, equipped with these, as you know, these PAC-3 ballistic missiles. Then you have the SM-3, the Navy system, based on their Aegis, their anti-aircraft missile system, which can protect, you know, within a couple hundred kilometers. And then we have the missile system in Alaska, and that was going to be installed in Poland.
Poland, right.
That can protect, you know, even farther, maybe 1,000 kilometers within, you know, range of it, and can knock down the longest range missiles, because the longer range missiles are harder to knock down because they come in faster. And that's why the Patriot only can take out, you know, sort of like Scud, you know, missiles that go for a couple hundred kilometers, maybe 500, 1,000 kilometers. The SM-3 and the Israeli system is in that the same category, can take out somewhat longer range missiles, you know, 1,000, 2,000 kilometers, which are the ones coming out of Iran. And then our heavy duty system, which we're apparently only going to have maybe 20 of them, depending on how the, you know, the budget is left alone or cut, can take care of anything. That is only an effective weapon against small players, people who only have a few missiles. But if the Iranians go ahead and build 100 of their longer range missile, the one they just tested the other day, which has a range of, you know, can reach Israel up to 2,000 kilometers, and put nuclear warheads on them, then the Israelis have a problem. Then you're back into the traditional Cold War situation of, do we strike them first?
Right.
Which is pretty dangerous stuff. Now, we sort of solve that problem by creating the Minuteman missile. That was about 40 years ago, in the 60s. We created a missile that could be launched in a minute. That's where the, basically the name inside the Air Force it came down to. It was a solid fuel missile with electronics that, you know, didn't have to be, you know, tweaked before you could launch it. The Russians, it took them decades to get away from a system where they had to spend, you know, hours and hours fiddling with the guidance system before they could launch either a liquid fuel or a solid fuel missile.
Right.
So the Minuteman was a brilliant innovation, which made first strike by the Russians impossible. And that's basically what kept everybody, you know, off their sedatives, you know, for most of the Cold War. But when you have a situation like Iran with 100 ballistic missiles armed with nuclear warheads and Israel, then it gets very tricky. And this is what everybody is trying to avoid. This is why the Russians are coming around now and saying, well, maybe we should crack down on, you know, on Iran. China is still saying, you know, the Iranians, we know how hard it is to make a reliable, you know, ballistic missile and nuclear warheads. We're still going through that stage. And the Chinese are basically more blasé. They're saying, well, so what? You know, we're making money right now. We don't think the Iranians would be a threat. We think, you know, the government will change before it gets that far. Now, for a Chinese politician, you know, thousands of kilometers away, it's easy to say that. But for the Israelis and the Gulf Arabs who are right next door to this problem and having to deal with it more in your face, they are less easygoing about it. So the Iranians still have a friend in China, but the entire world basically, at least the, you know, the industrialized world, is leaning on China. Say, look, it's easy for you to say, hey, I'm going to sell them whatever I can, you know, to make a quick buck. But there are other people who are basically looking at this as a matter of life and death. Everybody's looking, waiting for a regime change in Iran. But the Arabs will tell you, especially, I mean, the Arabs are the ones who are really worried about Iran. Because we tend to forget that before the Islamic dictatorship, you know, clergy took over in Iran in 79, Israel and Iran were allies. In fact, even during the Gulf War, between the war between Iraq and Iran in the 1980s, Israel did business with Iran. It was, you know, the enemy of my enemy is your friend. So the Iranians and the Israelis go way back and says, hey, we can do business with one another. But the Arabs, on the other hand, they see Iran as it has always been for thousands of years. They are the local superpower. And the Iranians are well aware of this, as are the people who have been continually, you know, time after time, subjugated. And the Iranians would love, you know, basically telling the Arabs that, you know, A, well, they've already told the Arabs that you really shouldn't be running Mecca, and that's really more than Arabs should be dealing with. You know, you just make a mess of it. Al-Qaeda's all you're for, yada, yada, yada. You go one step beyond that, and you're saying, well, you really shouldn't have control of the world's oil supply. You should have some adults like the Iranians dealing with that. And I think we'll just, you know, step across the Gulf and take charge. This is why the Iranians, the Arabs, the Gulf Arabs, are so friendly to America, which on so many other levels, they should hate us. Well, many of them do anyway, but they need us for the protection, and they really fear long-term and short-term Iran, and everybody believes that it's only a matter of time before the clerics lose control, because they're already hated by most Iranians. But in the meantime, the clerics are in charge, they are developing a nuclear weapon, and if things go wrong, you know, for too long, you're going to have a bunch of religious zealots with workable nuclear weapons and being called upon, you basically telling each other, well, we've said we should do it, maybe we should do it.
Right. And the whole thing is that it's better to stop it at this point than it is later on down the road, because the closer they get, the more leverage they have for their threat.
Exactly, and this is what everybody's saying, and of course the Europeans for a long time, and the Russians until quite recently, and the Chinese still are saying, don't worry about it, it'll never get that bad. Well, more and more people are basically saying, you know, it's getting closer and closer.
Right.
Once they have a working, they already have working missiles. Once they have a working, you know, once they have a working bomb, then you can basically set up a clock that's, say, 36 months long and say, well, baby, it, doomsday is X number of months away.
Right.
And at that point, the bulletin of the atomic scientists, you know, doomsday clock, you know, is seconds from midnight.
Right. And my biggest worry is that the most important thing over there is going to get ignored again, like it was during the 90s, which is that we need to continue to develop our intelligence assets, because intelligence is going to be the thing that lets us know what's happening. If they give any, you know, because they're not going to give a nuke to terrorists, but they may give them enough radioactive material that they can build a dirty bomb. Or it'll be stolen or whatever. And so the only way to counter a lot of this stuff is with better intelligence.
From what I know, and I have to choose my words carefully here, there is pretty good intelligence coming from within the Iranian leadership. It's a network of dozens of different factions. Actually sub-factions of major factions. The ones you have to worry about are the ones basically control the Revolutionary Guard, the army within the army, as it were, and the Al-Quds Force. In other words, they have a terrorist, their version of special forces is basically a bunch of people whose job is to encourage terrorism in other countries. We, the Israelis, the British, whatever, a lot of people are playing this game, have sufficient tentacles inside these organizations to know who has the clout to do what. Currently, the trends are going against the radicals. They're allowed to play, you know, games, non-nuclear games in various places. But apparently the decision has been made by the senior-most people that you guys are not going to get any nuclear material to play with. That said, the power struggle is in Iran. The radicals are always, you know, grasping for more power, more authority. So far they haven't been getting it. But that can change, because if there is a major uprising, not just the sort of middling stuff they had a month or so over the summer because of the crooked election, the ruling, junta, as it were, the clerics, the hundreds of clerics who basically run the country as their own personal fiefdom, they rely on the Revolutionary Guard to protect them, literally. Their wealth, their money, their families, and this is the relationship you have between the Revolutionary Guard and the adult, you know, supervision you have in Iran. And if the Revolutionary Guard gets, you know, the radicals in that group get greedy enough, now the people running the Revolutionary Guard are not considered radicals in the, you know, capital R radical sense, but they do have, you know, radicals as their allies. So you can see the possibility is there, given a certain situation, where the mullahs are going to have to basically give the radicals whatever they want. So the potential is there, and many people in the West, in Europe especially, and like I say, recently in Russia, and hopefully eventually in China, are going to realize that this is too risky a situation to let go, you know, by itself. It needs some outside, you know, influence to basically try and shut it down before it goes critical and we get a situation that everybody now, a lot of people now believe is impossible, but unfortunately is very probable, you know, if left alone and unattended.
Right. And so I think that's a good place for us to end, is that there needs to be some attention on this.
And apparently there is, but whether or not it'll be enough and in time, well, that is currently unknown.
Right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.